Welcome back to the Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
Hello, everyone. I am Tom Costera.
And in this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. All right, so let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for June 25th, 2025. What do you got for us?
Well, actually, before we kick off, yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if you've been following any of the conflict stuff. We usually... Actually, I think most of the comments we make before we dive in is usually around nation-related issues or geopolitical issues. But yeah, I noticed the conflict seems to be in a ceasefire right now over there, Iran.
The air quote ceasefire, right?
Not
sound negative or anything, but it is a crazy world that we live in right now, man. In our field, hiding some of my bias because I am in this field. You know, we live in a new era, so I think it's worth noting when it's ongoing that we should be paying attention to this stuff, man. The landscape as far as how wars are fought is absolutely changing, right? So on that cyber front, can't not see this as a breath of oxygen to a burning fire, right?
Yeah, and I same thing. Like when it comes to what people probably should be paying attention to is there is a much higher demand now to be in good position during ceasefires after potential conflicts, because if things escalate again, you know, you don't want to be caught off guard and you want to have an advantage. So things might not be as destructive as most cyber things tend to be with war related efforts or conflict related efforts. But I can imagine that there's going to be still the same level of persistence to gain footholds places. So it's good to pay attention to at least that kind of tactic or technical approach. So,
yeah, for many reasons, and I think everybody that's listening is probably aware of it to some degree. But you know, beyond, even if it isn't directly in your region or affected, like you're, I think we've proven time and time again over the course of the last 5 to 10 years that when situations like this arise, cyber activity increases.
Yeah, I would at a minimum, I'd be looking at, you know, if you have a Windows environment, run keys and schedule tasks. Just have an idea of what's in your environment, because I've seen a lot of off-the-shelf malware being used and a lot of times to exploit some of those things. But with that said, what do you got for us to kind of kick everything off?
All right. So away from conflicts into some interesting intel stuff. So the first thing I have this week is an article from Harfang Labs. It's titled Sad Future, Mapping XDSpy and Their Latest Evolution. So XDSpy is a bit of a lesser known, but a long running espionage group that's been active since 2011 and primarily targeting Eastern European and Russian government bodies. But they did start a new campaign back in March of this year using a 0-day LNK parsing exploit. So 0-day, I'll probably use the term vulnerability in there too, but I'm going to throw both of them in a little bit in air quotes. But leveraging this for a bit of a stealthy initial access, leveraging those LNK files. So kind of talking directly about that vulnerability / 0-day, it's kind of in the way that Windows handles the shortcut files, the .lnk files. So due to this, an attacker can craft a malicious LNK file that executes hidden commands when the user simply opens or previews the shortcut. But it does this by taking advantage of an extended white space allowance in the target text box of an LNK's properties file. And that box, by default, will show you 78 characters of code. So whatever your line is for execution in that text box, you'll get the first 78 characters. But it will give you all the way up to 259 characters. So what is happening here, basically, for example, if you want to launch that, if you have an LNK that you want to just say launches command.exe. So in that target text box, you'd have something like C/Windows/System32/command.exe. And then you might want to leverage some code execution once you launch that. So let's say you're opening command.exe, and then you want to just use command.exe to launch calc or notepad or something like that. So you throw in like a /C notepad.exe or calc, right? So to take advantage of this vulnerability /0-day, you'd simply put the command portion you want to execute beyond that 78 character mark, but within the 259 character limit. So the code would basically be hidden from sight in your general observation, opening, checking the file, et cetera, you wouldn't necessarily see what this thing was trying to do. It's kind of cool. I thought it was pretty neat. But from there, in this specific campaign, it would then execute and pull down the stage one, which is an ET downloader, which is a lightweight downloader that retrieves the main implant. And it uses standard Windows tools. So this is something definitely worth noting. So XD Spy is pretty known for leveraging like the standard Windows tool for files. So that will allow it to execute code or potentially across multiple files. But in this case, it'll execute for the next stage, which stage two is the XDGO implant, which is the Go-based backdoor. So what this backdoor does is collect screenshots, clipboard stuff, file lists, arbitrary files, things like that. But it also will encrypt the data and into a .enc file with random names. And then those encrypted files will be immediately deleted after it is exfilled. It also has the ability to run different commands like list, run, file, cc, delete, things like that. And they're fetched over HTTP GET requests and are encrypted. This one's interesting, I thought. Encrypted with RSA OAEP and signed with RSA PSS. So it will also establish the C2, which communicates, and the indicator specifically in this campaign was to quan-miami.com with random generated letters after, and it would include the drive serial number and the query params for targeting specifically. And then you'd also see the GET requests for the beacons and commands, but POST requests for exfiltration, as we would, and uses both. This is also something that I thought was interesting, at least from considering detections and hunts. So it uses both the Go HTTP default user agent and the browser like user agent to kind of blend in. So, you know, this overlaps with older XD spy campaigns, including the ARJ/NSIS chains that were active since May of this year. And then there's some historical linkage. So that XDGO use was something that Kaspersky actually discovered back in October of 2023 and has that ties to that consistent use of the four files Windows tool to kind of launch and work through its payload. So couple bullet points I marked down here I thought were good for the kind of detection slash hunting points of focus. Looking for LMK, parsing anomalies and hidden command arguments. Even though this is hidden to the eye, you should still generally be able to see what these are doing when you're looking at the log data. I think one that's definitely of note is flagging that use of the four files tool, especially when it's triggered from unexpected locations. And then one other item would be watching for the creation of the .enc files and looking for opportunities there. But yeah, I just thought this one was this had some fun thesis, Scott. Like that LMK, you know, vulnerability zero day is neat. And that robust C2 design that had like RSA-based authentications, the mixed user agents, and kind of that serialized drive IDs to help with the stealth and targeting and whatnot. I thought it was pretty cool. What were your takeaways?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, we were kind of briefly talking about this beforehand, and we're talking about this being like a vulnerability per se, but it's interesting because it's not like a technical vulnerability. It's more of a, I don't know, user vulnerability. I've heard the term like out of view, or, you know, where you're kind of taking advantage of the UI. It seems like that's kind of what it is as far as being able to hide things. And it also reminded me of a similar attack where people were attacking autofill in your web browser, where if you have autofill set up, it either drop credit card information or specific PII information or something like that that's stored in your browser, they would actually have the fields hidden off screen. So when you think you're putting in, you know, say just your name or something like that, it's autofilling somewhere else and they're collecting information from you. Kind of a similar trick, except for one's for stealing information, obviously. So that's kind of an interesting use, especially when people are trying to be due diligent, or if you're just moving fast as an analyst, you might say, oh, this is nothing here. But, you know, they're using for the delivery technique, it's really common of what we see. One, they're having everything in a container. In this case, it's a zip. So when you look at emails and things coming in that have archives or some sort of container that has multiple files, that to me is, I would say, kind of suspicious. Because, you know, especially what's in there. And then you have LNK file being dropped, as well as an EXE and a DLL. And in this case, they're taking advantage of DLL sideloading, right? Like we've talked about before, when you see they're using a legitimate executable that it, when it was written or created, had this sideloading vulnerability, and they're providing a malicious DLL with the name DLL it's trying to load, so they're able to get their stuff loaded in. So, you know, common things to kind of look for. We've talked about it before with this type of technique. When you see an EXE and a DLL kind of being written at the same time, or when they're same time window in the same directory, that can be questionable, especially if it's outside where you would like to install things and stuff like that. So that'd be like a quick and easy detection that something has landed. All the other activity might be a little harder to discern, but I always like to start with, you know, the things that are the most obvious and work my way across. So those are some interesting things there. But yeah, it's always interesting to see actors exist this long, right? You said back 2011. And
yeah,
they're leveraging
2011.
Yeah, and some of these techniques they're using now obviously would have worked back then, but there are techniques we're seeing very commonly today. So I'm assuming they've adapted to this. I don't know what they used previously. My guess is they were probably using some office docs and macros because that was more prevalent. But you know, you can see how actors even can evolve, and the things they're evolving to are just things that work for everybody, if you think about it that way. So looking for those common traits that actors use across the board can get you a lot of leverage, because even if people change tactics, they usually change to what's working for everybody else. So, yeah.
What do you got next for us?
So, yeah, the next one I thought was just kind of interesting. And I think I've already heard about this, but there was an article about it. It's something I just pulled off Bleeping Computer, but it was in reference to, you know, we've talked about click fix a lot. And this is titled New File Fix Attack Weaponizes Windows File Explorer for Stealthy Commands. So we've seen click fix used in many different ways, and they've tried to trick people to do things in many different ways. But there was a researcher who was looking at what other ways can you execute things that you copy from a clipboard or get, you know, paste from a clipboard. And so he kind of took a different approach. Went instead of doing your CAPTCHA verification and trying to, you know, get, you know, people getting access that way, the social engineering approach is really around, hey, you know, there's a file you need and you're having issues getting to the file that you're tricked to want to go fetch. And it gives you like an alternative way where you can, if you click here and then you paste it into your file browser window. And I don't remember if you made the Explorer window pop up on its own as far as some function, or you had to open it yourself. But either way, if you put anything into that file explorer window, file explorer window at the top, you know, where you normally put the path to whatever file you want access to, if there's commands there, they get run. And so kind of like what you were talking about with the LNK in the white space, you can put enough white space and break characters in that entire path, so it looks like you're just providing a path to a file, but preceding it that's not visible, what could be, you know, a command line structure. In this case, for his proof of concept, it was calling PowerShell to run ping. So it was just an interesting, you know, I kind of expect when interesting ways that adversaries are using or techniques they're using to get users to do certain things, to enable their attacks, it becomes like a field of study, right? And it's like, okay, wait, if we know that people are willing to paste things from their clipboard, how many different ways can we get someone to paste something that will achieve our objectives? And then it kind of bypasses a lot of the defense tools, because it's user-driven activity versus you trying to get something shuttled in. So it was just an interesting approach, interesting research around it. And you know, it just makes me think, like, I wonder what other ways that you can do these things, which I'm sure people are thinking about. So, yeah, I would have to guess, and I haven't tested this, but where my brain went to when even looking at this is, okay, if, say, the Explorer, because I'm assuming that's going to be the parent process when you're in File Explorer and it launches something. It's not uncommon for it to launch things, but it might be uncommon for there to be command line. Because a lot of times when you launch things from Explorer, you're double clicking in most aspects. Or even if you put a path to an executable, it's going to run the executable, but there's going to be no commands typically provided. So just seeing command line associated with a Windows Explorer launch of something might be suspect to something like this. So I haven't tested it. It's something that I think would be pretty easy to test. So if you're listening and you want to try something out like that and see what it looks like in the data, I would definitely go check it out. But yeah, so I figured I'd just throw something because around quick fix or file fix or any other type of fix that could exist out there, just to make people aware that, you know, a lot of these attacks evolve, or, you know, new things are uncovered because of new ways people are operating. So yeah, what was your take?
Yes, I like the attempt to use the common, a very commonly used technique and kind of put its spin on it. I still shudder at the idea of where, like, you know, being a phishing email with a open File Explorer button in it and then users clicking it. It freaks me out. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
But you know, the technique itself is interesting. And I kind of want to know for sure if it shows the command line. So it's almost like something I want to take to the lab and just, you know, just to verify. I don't know. Have you done that yet?
I haven't, but I don't know if internally we've talked about this in the past or someone was testing it, but I feel like I'm not the first one to have that idea. But I do think it's a logical approach, right? Based on data I've seen before, but like I said, I haven't tested it, but that's when you think about these problems, sometimes it's really good to start with in your hypothesis, right? What you already know. So luckily I've at least had some experience looking at the data.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's pretty interesting. It's pretty cool too. That's, you know, they were considering, okay, how do I become, you know, hide my malicious stuff from the user, you know, by adding that dummy file path into the, you know, as a comment after the command, it basically hides it from it. You know, it's just pretty cool. It's pretty interesting to see that. I mean, cool in a way that it's fun to see how attackers are thinking through new ways to use stuff that's actually being used. So we use on our toes at least.
Yeah, you got to think, like, I can see with the CAPTCHA thing, like, someone builds and spends all this time on user awareness training. And so everyone's thinking, well, if it's CAPTCHA, I should question it, right? But they're missing the point that they're copying something and pasting it somewhere else, not in the browser. You know, it's that behavior you want people to pick up on, not the fact that it might be a fake CAPTCHA. And I bring that up because sometimes when we try to train users, we try to, get so specific that we make them blind. An example of that is I remember dealing with a phishing incident and, you know, trying to brief people on, oh, there was a malicious attachment. And they're like, wait a second. I thought for something to be phishing, it had to be a link you were enticed to click. Like, that's the only phishing. I was like, no. Like, I was just kind of taken back. Like, how do we miss the education on it? There could be bad attachments that you open as well, you know? So I think about it the same way, right? You got to be careful when you're also training people to not put up artificial blinders because you're trying to make it too simple.
The quick fix one is for a while going to just, it confound me, mainly because it's just, yeah. And like, I'm not trying to sound elitist or at all, because we're in this field, right? And we would think of this, that's not what I'm getting at in any way. It's just that it just in my brain, it defies logic, because you do have the user training, right? But beyond that, I just can't think of normal day-to-day users, at least in my experience, where they would be doing these kinds of things ever. So in my mind, you would think, okay, this is something very novel to me as a user to do. I should immediately put my question on, or my question add on, right? Like, what am I doing here, right? Just a little bit of pause. It's crazy how effective this has been, this technique has been in my
mind. The one thing I do appreciate is now I remember when I used to be like, God, I can't believe people are just opening junk from random emails that get sent to them. Now it puts that in perspective. You're like, okay, I can see they could fall for that, but they fall for this, you know? It's like.
Yeah, it's this weird thing. It's like we're going backwards almost, like, and it's interesting. It'd be cool to see. I know this will never happen, but it'd be cool to see like a full-fledged study on the human psyche and how and why this is effective. I know it'll never be done, but it's just fascinating to think about.
Well, like we always joked when we did our phishing campaigns for testing, right? It was like, what if we just send a link that just says "click me"? You know, like how many people would fail?
How many people would?
Or if you make the button just look like a red button and it's an image that you can click, how many people would just click it versus like a green button? Like how much of the human psyche is associated with this? I just want to know.
Because of the color.
Curiosity.
Yeah. Well, I bet you there's phishing trains going on now where they're testing people copying and pasting and running commands. I would imagine that's happening. That's his point.
I think I would have too much fun if I was actually responsible for that, because I wouldn't be more interested about generating the data than actually making sure the users are trained, you know?
Yeah.
But I'm sure like it
Oh,
would
yeah.
make the users look bad because I'm like, well, that was really tricky. I'm like, well, that's the point, right? This is more of a game, and hopefully they get excited when they do win because it's not supposed to be easy. But yeah.
Right.
So, cool. What do you got next?
All right. So this one I think is pretty interesting, and I'm really interested to hear your takes on it. So, this is from Huntress, and it's an article titled "Feeling Blue Noroff Inside a Sophisticated DPRK Web3 Intrusion." So, Blue Noroff is a North Korean threat group that's under the Lazarus umbrella, and they targeted a cryptocurrency organization using a very sophisticated and tailored social engineering attack. And the attack began with a deep fake Zoom call that was set up via Calendly and Telegram. So the call had deep fake versions of known senior leadership within that company, as well as some external attendees as well. And during that meeting, the targeted victim here was unable to use the microphone because when they clicked the link that was set up for Zoom, it took them to a malicious Zoom link. So they had it set up to where the microphone wouldn't work. And when the user mentioned as such, the deepfakes in the meeting convinced the victim to install a Zoom extension that was actually a malicious Apple script downloaded via Telegram and executed automatically. Once executed, the script would disable bash history logging and auto install Rosetta 2 if it was missing, enabling the Intel binary execution on Apple Silicon. And then it would download a second stage binary to temp iCloud underscore helper. Then it would prompt the user for a pseudo password so it could elevate. And then it would also wipe the shell history to kind of help evade forensics review. So the malware chain featured a range of macOS implants. They were written in NIM, Go, C++, Objective-C, and Objective-C with capabilities that were, I'll read through a few bullet points here. So you had Telegram 2, which was written in MIM, which was a persistent loader that was launched via launch daemons. And then you had another one called Root Trojan V4, which is written in Go. And this is the main backdoor that would fetch and run the payloads and have periodic beaconing. Another implant was inject with DYLD. This was the C++ script that would decrypt and inject further payloads into a legitimate Swift app. Then you had your NIM Trojan, which injected the implant using WebSockets that would help with C2 communication. You'd have Xscreen, which was written in Objective C. This was your key logging, clipboard captures, screenshot, exfil, things like that. CryptoBot, written in Go, specialized info stealer that would targeting specifically cryptocurrency files and wallets. And then you had a NetCHK, which was basically a harmless process, likely used as a decoy or a keep alive indicator. But the toolset showed advanced stealth techniques like delayed execution when the screen was off, zero wiping payloads, and bypassing detection with macOS debug entitlements. The operation pretty much highlighted Blue Noroff's ongoing focus at Web3 compromise and kind of their growing expertise in macOS targeted intrusions, which is definitely worth noting because there was a lot here, a lot of depth here. a couple things that I tagged as I've been trying to do with each of my articles for like the detection hunting side. So script oddities, identifying some like unsigned Apple scripts and kind of that pseudo elevation with unusual shell downloads. The launch daemon auditing, I think this one's pretty big. So monitoring unknown daemons, like the one that was used here, which was, you know, com.telegram2.update, et cetera. And then the obviously one that, you know, we've talked about before and it's pretty common on the side and on the Windows side, but looking for that sudden deletion of the history files, of the log history, shell history, suspicious zero writes, things like that. But yeah, you know, the biggest point that I found the most interesting here, other than some of the depth with the Mac OS stuff, because there was a lot here. Obviously there's some sophistication here as far as writing this malware and the payloads for Mac, but the very targeted, very tailored, and very focused social engineering attack on this deepfake call. So leveraging deepfake to impersonate people that you knew in your company. I mean, I can't, this is one where, you know, we typically go through these different events. And when we see that a user gets hosed, we can kind of see where they made a mistake. This one, I actually have a hard time seeing how I could really blame the user because it seemed that good. I think for me, at least, Scott, this is the first time I've seen anything like this, where they went to this depth, they had this much information around this user, this company, the employees around it, and they targeted an employee that was probably slightly lower scale so they could get into the system. I'm assuming there, I actually don't know that, but somebody that fell for this deepfake, and you know, I'd be curious to see exactly how good it was, but just the thought process of that is interesting. Like that leverage of AI tools to execute this social engineering for a actual cyber attack is just really interesting, man. So I don't know what went through your head when you read this and looked at this.
Yeah. So I think it's always interesting when you look at, any kind of cyber operation, you know, if there's a constant moving mark, or, you know, objectives are kind of always changing, or the motive slightly changes, it seems like you'll see some of the tradecraft kind of, you know, get carried along from previous experience or previous engagements forward, but then they kind of have to create a new playbook, right? And they kind of, and so that's how you kind of see a lot of things evolve. What's interesting about this is, especially like when you look at North Korea and how they want to embed people into companies, and a lot of it is how do they engage with employees, either like for getting a job, you know, fulfill a position to get access that way, or in this other way where they're trying to get people. But that whole business type interaction, it's almost like they're maturing their SOPs and their capabilities within the same realm, right? Like, I feel like if you've put enough resources and time, that like social aspect, understanding those engagements better, what works, what doesn't, what you need, like where your weaknesses are to like bolster those, you see way more mature approaches. So it seems like they're kind of mastering this, right? I think as you're seeing evolutions with these types of engagements and knowing what common tools to use and how to leverage those, to the point where they even had, you know, a malicious domain of a .biz that looked very common to the Zoom stuff. I mean, that takes some time and planning. And I'm assuming they I don't know what the reputation score of that is, but they may have even spent time to build up the reputation of some of the domains they're using too, right? Because that would immediately make this fall on its head as well. So that, you know, there's that aspect from like the social part of it, which I think is cool to see. But that's where you really start to see some more sophistication, is when people dwell on the same approach or aspect of things. The other thing that I always think is interesting is Mac attack so far, right? Anything on Apple stuff, Apple's kind of designed, I mean, it's a Unix, you know, based operating system. So like Unix, Linux, there's some similarities there, but Apple's the one operating system where it is kind of constrained a lot more than the other OSs, for good reason, right? Like Apple likes to control their stuff and enable their users to use their product like the tool they intended it to use, versus like you can take a Linux OS or even Windows and you can, there's like 100 million different ways to do the same thing, right? I feel like Apple's more streamlined in a lot of ways. And that helps them have really optimized platform. But because of that, I always see some of the same techniques kind of always being leveraged. And I bring that up for like persistence, for instance. You know, they're using the library launch daemon or daemon with the plist. Like, that's just like the most, I mean, I almost want to say every Mac malware I've seen that needed persistence, that's kind of the route they go. I don't know. I'm assuming there's got to be other ways for persistence, but that's like the go-to way. Almost like when we would say a lot of the off-the-shelf malware stuff is like the registry run keys and Windows. But there's other things we know that are common for persistence. Mac, this seems to really be, you know, embedded in this plist launch daemon. So that stood out. The other thing that stood out, which is, you know, a common trait of Windows, is, I'm sorry, Windows, Unix and Linux, is when you pull down something you want to execute by calling it, you have to chmod it. You have to change those permissions. And I'm trying to think what nation state did it. I don't think it was specifically North Korea. But there was another nation state that when they were able to successfully get in somewhere, and it was through exploitation, not through social engineering, same exact steps. They curled to get their payloads and then immediately chmodded that to make it executable. So that's just behavior in tandem is always interesting to see and look out for. And you can see that, you know, from a command line perspective as well as from a network perspective. Some of that, but that's the other thing I was going to get into with Mac, is you got to have the right tools, have the right visibility. I think that's where a lot of people struggle. A lot of people don't add a lot of third-party tools for that. I don't know really other than, you know, the mainstream EDRs, I don't know what main tools or what tools open source even that would get you some of that. But, you know, the fact they're actually deleting history and things shows that they feel pretty confident that most people don't have that, and if someone needed to investigate something, that's where they would go to figure out what happened. And if they're removing it, you know, that's a good sign that they covered their tracks. I also like the I want to say they were prompting trying to get the user to put a password in. I don't know if I was reading that correctly. And then if they provided the right password, it was successful. If they didn't, then it would fail, as if there was like some install thing that they had to do. And they were doing that test against sudo. But I don't know if they were just pulling straight from the password file or what. But I've had this feeling like they were actually prompting the user to put in. And that's how they're able to elevate, which was kind of a cool technique if that's really what was happening. But I'm kind of looking through their code. Obviously, seeing people remove, like I mentioned, the histories, but they focus on, you know, multiple history files. So, you know, that's, they're trying to be thorough. It shows that they've kind of been dealing with this type of environment as far as an OS to know what they need to touch. So those are some pretty big giveaways as well. So, you know, that's like the big areas that I typically would focus on, right, are some of those early steps. And like I said, a lot of times those early steps are consistent amongst a lot of attacks. So it's good to know something went on that you need to investigate further, and then you could try to stitch this stuff together. But also know that if you don't have great visibility and you don't have much in the history, for instance, then you almost had to suspect that something's actually happened to the box as well. So, you know, you're one of those problems where if you run into a blind spot and you don't know, you kind of almost got to play it safe and say, yeah, I don't trust this machine anymore, and go that route. But yeah, so it's always kind of cool to see how attackers are attacking Macs, what they're doing slightly differently, what they care about. And then, you know, like you hit on before, the social engineering aspects was just really well thought out, I guess.
Yep, very well dolled out. Yeah, we don't see a lot of Mac stuff usually, right? Especially in comparison to, you know, Windows.
Oh yeah,
for various reasons. But it is always cool to see what people are creating and coming up with.
Yeah.
All right. Last but not least for this week, Scott, what do you got for us?
So this one was interesting. It was reported on GB Hackers, and it's talking about a recent Notepad++ vulnerability. And, you know, they phrase it as allows full system takeover. This is interesting because it's similar to when we talk about DLL sideloading technique, right? So the idea of DLL sideloading is an executable is, I would say, poorly written. So when it tries to load a DLL, it calls it, you know, by name. So it has to be named correctly. But the places it looks first is, one, if it has a specified location in the code where it knows what path to even look for it, then it's more secure because then it has to be that almost that DLL or it has to exist in the right directories, which means it's probably installed correctly. Then it will usually, the next step, if it doesn't have that, it will look locally, meaning in the same directory wherever the executable is being run from. And a lot of times that's what's commonly used when they were making executables, because if someone were to pull a program, you know, move an executable around, then it would always work as long as it was with this adjacent files. So it was more like a user-friendly way of coding. And then the last one is, okay, if the DLL it's looking for isn't specified, isn't locally with it, then it looks in the system folders like system32 for that DLL to load it that way. As like the last resort, maybe it's just looking for a system DLL, and so it doesn't need to have an extra copy somewhere else. So that's like the search order, right, of how things get loaded. And so, for instance, if it's expecting a system DLL, but you provide something named with that system DLL locally, I think it hits that one first before it looks in the system. So that's why coding, how things are coded are important. It creates that kind of vulnerability that attackers discover, and then they leverage. This is interesting because it's about the install of Notepad++. And when installing it, it has a dependency for an executable, which is the regsrv32.exe. So it's not a DLL, but it's an executable. And because of how it's set up to look for that, you know, it's trying to fall back on probably the same search order, you know, you would expect for DLL, where it would eventually fall back to the system32, pull the native Windows executable it's trying to call. But in this case, they were able to find that if you have some executable, whatever you want to run, and you rename it with that name locally with the installer, it will launch it. And the thing about installers, if it's a trusted installer, then it usually runs those at a system level. So now, understanding this type of vulnerability or this find, all you have to do is basically have the installer for Notepad++ of this version and that regsrv32 malicious name file next to it, and you basically have system access with whatever you ran from there, right? So this is just an interesting kind of tangent to what we've been seeing with DLL sideloading. I wonder how many other installers have this vulnerability as well. And I think it's tough. I'm assuming the install will fail if it calls the wrong executable. Like, I don't know, but it seems like a really easy way to elevate privileges by just now moving over a normal set installer. But now you're also moving to executable. So a lot of times that's like a red flare for, EDRs and things when they see executables being sent somewhere or whatever. But, you know, if you're able to convince someone to download it, or I mean, imagine click fix, right? You can probably click fix this whole thing together, but, it's something now that there is this version that's out there. If you get your hands on it, I'm assuming that you will be able to leverage this installer, whenever you want. Like, you know, they patch it, so now if you were to pull down the latest Notepad++ installer, yeah, it's not vulnerable to that. But, you know, usually the problem we see even with DLL sideloading is people find the old executables that are vulnerable, and you can still use them today. There's nothing wrong with them other than they can be taken advantage of. So this kind of puts a new risk out there. And I was trying to think of ways to even look for this. And it'd be similar to, I guess, how it handled the DLL stuff. You see two executables being written to the same directory. That's suspicious. That's outside of an install type setup. So you have that. And I don't know, to be honest, now that I'm thinking about it, I haven't looked at the Notepad++ installer lately. I'm assuming it there could even be an MSI file. So you almost have to look for that pairing too, MSI and EXE, depending on how they deliver that. I haven't seen this technique. I guess it makes complete sense, and I haven't really thought of it before, so I guess I'm not shocked by it. But I don't think I've ever seen anyone take advantage of this that I'm aware of in my career, looking at cyber attack based things and privilege escalations and stuff. So I don't know if you've seen anything like this or what your thoughts are.
No, it was pretty interesting. A little scary. But yeah, ultimately, so unless I read it wrong, so they were doing part of this attack technique too, is one way to kind of like track, you know, things you don't want to see that are similar to this, is they were leveraging that Reg Server 32.exe, like a malicious that was placed somewhere that was abstract to where you would normally see it, right? So in theory, wouldn't that be another way to kind of track suspicious activity like this, seeing executable ran from a non-standard kind of place? Or am I reading this incorrectly?
No, yeah, you can think of it that way. And I don't even know what the parent-child relationship would be, but you might even be able to say, because I think when you launch an installer, there is like a system run executable that's like install whatever, right? I think, or mm-hmm. forgot the, but I think there is. And if that's the case, you may even be able to leverage like, hey, the installer shield or whatever it is that is used to install things on the system called an executable from weird location, which you also be suspect too, right? So you might be able to tie in a little more telemetry to help narrow in on that. But yeah, it's a good point.
Yeah, these are definitely vulnerabilities to be aware of, and does show that there was a released version that they put out seemingly relatively quickly, right? That leveraged apps and paths for dependencies and, you know,
and it's
implemented secure temporary directories, things like that.
And it's tough here because it's not just like getting administrator privilege or something like this. When you get system, you pretty much can get anything off the system that you want. So it makes those next steps in attack that much easier, even if you have good security controls on the system. So that's why I think this one's a little clearer than your typical DLL sideloading. Like, that just gets your stuff executed, right, under the context of a user. This just basically takes the system over. I mean, it really is a takeover the way they describe it, at least.
Yeah, it's really cool. Really scary. Really cool.
Yeah. So, with that, before we close out, they got some updates that I want to mention. We do have our Live Out of the Woods edition, which is the intersection of AI and threat hunting, what problems emerge and what problems get solved. That'll be July 10th from 12 to 1:30 Eastern Standard Time. So that'll be kind of a fun one to kind of dive into. This is the different areas of AI today and how some things have changed and how some things have gotten harder. Kind of give our two cents and so much. Hopefully get some good conversation going. Then we'll also have an Intel-driven threat hunting workshop, analyzing malware behaviors. That'll be July 31st from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So it's going to be a good deep dive workshop and understanding, looking at malware and behaviors that malware kind of does that you can see from a threat hunting perspective. So definitely worth checking out. With that, I want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast today. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And with that, that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of June 25th, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.